From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today we talk with Congresswoman Debbie Dingell about the presidential race. It's been 4 years since she predicted Donald Trump's surprise win in Michigan. We'll ask what she sees in 2020. Also, why Michigan, yes, Michigan, might be a contender for a new rocket launch site.
You'll recognize a lot of companies with a footprint in Michigan that have been involved in developing the kind of sensors, power systems that you'll find in communication satellites, not just scientific missions.
And the deeply divergent plans for converting Michigan power companies to renewable energy.
I think that what the commission's decision gives them is the opportunity to signal a cultural shift and an acceptance that they are going to move into Michigan's energy future and not stick with the old way of doing things.
All that's coming up on today's edition of Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. On the show today, the future of renewable energy in Michigan. It's going to depend a lot on what the state's two largest private utility companies decide to do. We'll take a look at plans put forth by DTE and Consumers Energy and what they might mean for Michigan's customers in the energy future. But first, if Democrats were looking for direction in the Democratic primaries, they certainly got some kind of sign from the Nevada caucuses over the weekend. Vermont's Senator Bernie Sanders won a decisive victory among voters under 30, but also voters 45 to 64, and overwhelming support from Latino voters of all ages. His win set the stage for make-or-break moments going into this week's upcoming primaries. This seemed like a timely moment to speak with one of the most prescient voices in the party. Congresswoman Debbie Dingell represents Michigan's 12th district. Congresswoman Dingell, welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you. It's great to be here and to be with you for the first time. Well, welcome to back to home or back into Michigan.
Thank you very much. It is absolutely a joy to be here. Were you very surprised to see Senator Sanders win so big in Nevada this weekend?
No, not really. But I still think it's a competitive primary. One of the things I'm very focused on is that I think the presidential nominating system is broken. I took it on in 2008, and it became part of the candidate politics instead of really changing the system. I swore I was never going to touch it again. And and this isn't one candidate based or another candidate based. I think we need a primary nominating system that allows every state to have an opportunity to have candidates live in their state, talk about their issues. And I think Nevada is at least a diverse state, but these smaller states have, I think, too big an impact on the presidential nominating system, which has nothing to do with who's winning or not winning. But when you don't know who the winner is in Iowa for a week and you get maybe false momentum or you're not getting accurate reporting and the candidates aren't, and other states talking about the issues that matter to them, I'm not surprised. I'm not endorsing any candidate.
Do you think you will at some point this season?
I will not be for the primary in Michigan. I will endorse the candidate that the people of the 12th district elect. I remember the tension of 4 years ago between the Sanders people and the Hillary Clinton people, and I believe that contributed to the victory of this president, and I believe we have all got to unite at the end of this process behind whoever the candidate is. And I will be, my strongest effort will be on uniting to win in November.
Does that mean considering Bernie Sanders the presumptive nominee at this point?
I think he could win Michigan if the election were held today. I will make that prediction, but everybody's got a right to vote. And we got to stop these primary systems that, hey, this is the candidate. We have to have a fair system where every state has the opportunity to talk about the candidates, to witness candidates, have the momentum, the issues that matter to them be an impact in this primary nominating system. So I want to see a system where you're not saying to me in February, is this the candidate? But how do we, 4 years ago, everybody was like, it's going to be Hillary, even though I predicted and a lot of people were upset with me that Bernie Sanders was going to win in Michigan 4 years ago, too, when we got to that weekend. And even as I predict that now, let me be really clear. It's a long time between now and March 10th.
Not only did you predict a victory for Bernie Sanders, you were the Cassandra of the Democratic Party in 2016, going public with your belief that Donald Trump was capable of winning a state like Michigan. Is what you're hearing now this year very different than what you were hearing from constituents back then?
I'm hearing some of the same comments and some different comments. This district is a very complicated district. I have working men and women who want to know that somebody cares about them, that's going to fight for their job, that is going to do something about bad trade deals, that is going to lower the cost of their prescription drugs. There are union workers with a lot of worries, from health care to their pensions being safe. And I think many of them still think Democrats aren't caring about those issues. We have to do a better job to show them that we do, and how we've actually passed bills that are addressing those issues. But we got to do a better job of talking to working men and women across this country.
What do those comments that you hear, how does that inform what you think about in terms of what the eventual Democratic nominee will have to do to take on a candidate, to take on Donald Trump's reelection bid? Say it's Bernie Sanders. I mean, could he scoop up voters who might be attracted to a more moderate vice presidential pick?
He's going to have to talk to them. He's going to have to. But you know what? One of the things I want to say this. I was in a hall this weekend. And by the way, Washtenaw is very clearly going to support a strong Democratic candidate, although there are people with concerns. But I was in a hall yesterday, and a labor hall, I'm not going to tell you which one, and someone was really worried about we're going to elect a communist. And I said, he's not a communist. He's a democratic socialist. And President Trump very successfully went on during the State of the Union, called people who just care about their neighbor. I had another worker yesterday that said, they've got good health care, this union. But his neighbor's premiums are $2,500 a month, and their deductible is $10,000 a month, and they're worried about their neighbor being able to get health care. That's not a communist or a socialist. We're the only industrialized nation in the world that doesn't guarantee its citizens health care.
Did you think that in your lifetime, post-Cold War, post-Obamacare, really, that words like communist and socialist would be thrown around in a presidential election debate?
No, I did not. And I'm going to also tell you that I never thought we would see the kind of hate that we are seeing in this country. And the fact of the matter is, this is the truth. People need to understand this. There are heads of Homeland Security who have been fired for simply reporting that multiple national security agencies know that Russia is trying to intervene in our election. On, you know, Senator Sanders was told, I haven't been briefed by the campaign, but I read it in the news like other people did, that Russia is trying to help him the way that it's not a... That shouldn't be an issue that makes someone have a temper tantrum. It should be an issue that should scare all of us. If you talk to intelligence agencies in other democracies around the world, they know that Russia is trying to destabilize democracies. We can't take our democracy for granted. We learn in grade school, high school, what a democracy is, about freedom of speech, freedom of religion, freedom of press. And if you had asked me at this age, in this time in my life, basic freedoms that we take for granted are actually under threat, I would never have believed it. And we need to think about that.
It's understood that in Washington, D.C., sometimes the wheels of democracy slow down as candidates, especially presidents running for reelection, need to spend time on the campaign trail. What do you think is realistic about the pace of work in Washington, D.C. this year? Is there anything that must get done or should get done?
Well, I think there are a lot of things that should get done. I mean, the House has passed more than 400 bills. Almost 300 of them have been bipartisan. Senator McConnell was asked if there was anything that we could get done, and he did name a number of issues that matter. We need to lower the cost of prescription drugs. Everybody knows we need to. We should be able to figure out something we can agree to. It's a crisis for too many Americans, most Americans. He said we could agree on conservation efforts. I'm very proud of a bill that I've got, the Resource Wildlife Recovery Act, which will put money directly, it's called RAWA, will put money directly into the states for conservation efforts. And it is one of the most bipartisan bills that is being considered in the House right now. And I'd like to see that get done. But infrastructure, we got to fix, I'm going to use the word, the damn roads. And people, I hate that word, I told her that, but people like it, they get it. We got to work together to fix our roads, our bridges, broadband in rural areas. We need to fix our schools and bring them up to par. There are so many things that we need to do. We should be able to find common ground to get it done. And we do get some things done. We're protecting the Great Lakes. That is a very bipartisan effort, not only in the state of Michigan, but in surrounding states.
We're welcoming you back in this day before Fat Tuesday. And you arrived with Ponchki. Any Ponchki is a welcome Ponchki here at Michigan Radio, and we are very grateful to you. I just wanted to say that I don't think I want to live in the kind of Michigan where we cannot sit down across partisan lines and break jam-filled holiday pastry together. Very much appreciate that. Do you feel like people still can agree on certain things and have enough common culture to be like that with each other?
We need to. You know, today's a day that we celebrate the Polish tradition, of which my husband's family was. We need to share all of our traditions at different parts of the year, study other cultures, know that we each have different perspectives that we bring to each other. We can disagree agreeably. I think my favorite saying has become this year, because I think civility is so important, respecting each other, respect, Aretha Franklin's respect. God gave us two ears and one mouth for a reason. We need to listen more.
Congresswoman Debbie Dingell, thank you so much for stopping by. We welcome you with Ponchki or without anytime.
Thank you. But happy Ponchki Day.
Thank you. Coming up on the show, the possibility of a new rocket launch site on Lake Huron. It's highlighting Michigan's growing aerospace industry.
You'll recognize a lot of companies with a footprint in Michigan that have been involved in developing the kind of sensors, power systems that you'll find in communication satellites, not just scientific missions.
That's just around the corner here on Stateside. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Tonight in Detroit, a town hall meeting offers a chance to help shape a plan to reform the legal system as most Americans experience it. The criminal justice system has its issues, but far more people will at some point find themselves involved in a civil matter. If you're getting married or divorced, if you're in dispute with a neighbor or a landlord, if you ever have to take a parent's will to probate, you're going to find out all about it. Justice Brian Zara of the Michigan Supreme Court is our guest today. He's part of the Justice for All Task Force that is considering reforms to the civil justice system in Michigan. Justice Zara, welcome to Stateside.
Pleasure to be here, April. Thanks for having me.
What would you like for most Michiganders to know if they ever have to have an interaction with the civil justice system?
Oh, that's a loaded question, right? So we hope that everybody gets through the civil justice system with a positive experience. But the fact of the matter is that most of the time when you are brought into court or when you are forced to go to court to pursue your rights, it is an unpleasant experience. It is an experience where you have a sense of injustice and you are there to right a wrong or to make sure that a wrong isn't imposed upon you, and it becomes a problem in your life. And so getting through that process is a difficult one, and it's made even more difficult when people are sued or have civil proceedings brought against them and they don't have the resources to obtain a lawyer.
three out of four civil cases we know are played out with people representing themselves in court. How does that representation or lack thereof, how does that affect outcomes in civil cases?
Well, it has two impacts. One, it results in the litigation proceeding on an uneven playing field, because if one party has a lawyer and the other side does not, it's simply not possible to get through those proceedings on a level playing field. The other impact that it has on our system is that it materially slows down the process. If both sides are represented by counsel, you're able to get a just result in a quicker way. But when one side's unrepresented, the court takes additional time to make sure that person who's proceeding on their own has a fair shake. And so, our reforms are not necessarily always to have a lawyer by their side, but to provide information. By the way, the town hall meeting tonight is for purposes of gathering information. We want to know, we want to hear from people who've had issues. Where did you go for help? Were you able to find help?
What worked and what didn't.
Exactly.
Right.
And even more importantly, we're going to try to find out who never even seeks out help, who has legal problems and perhaps doesn't even realize they have a legal issue, where they can gain some help through Michigan Legal Help or through the recommendations and reforms that we're going to propose.
What kinds of subjects have been on the table as the commission has just been in sort of the fact-finding stage?
Actually, we're getting some outstanding advice. We had a town hall in Grand Rapids last week, and a lot of people came in. Many times it was lawyers, sometimes non-lawyers, who had some good advice for us on revising forms, changing, for example, we had one recommendation that I thought was an insightful one on putting tougher standards or more stringent standards on alternative service up front. So oftentimes if there's a litigation that started, and the party who starts litigation says, we can't find the defendant, they can do alternative service by putting a notice in the newspaper that equates to service. Then a judgment is entered against them without them ever coming into court. And they don't even know about it until, all of a sudden they're able to be found once the judgment is entered and there's a garnishment.
Someone gets picked up in a traffic stop or other matter, and it's like the weight of the world just slams down.
Not necessarily a traffic stop, but what typically will happen is you find out that someone has a employment and then they'll garnish their pay for that judgment that they got without having the party ever come to court.
There are many aspects of just basic court information that are not very readily available. Michigan's court system has an e-filing system, but people may still be at a loss to get some pretty basic details about when and how cases are heard. Is there any prospect of making information more accessible?
That is the goal at the end of the day. We hope to bring more lawyers into the process and provide people with access to lawyers, whether that be through legal aid clinics or pro bono services offered by law firms or through another method that's available in Michigan, what's called limited scope representation. But when we don't have lawyers, we need to make the ability to gain information more accessible, whether that be through better training of our court staff. Perhaps some states allow, like for example, Washington State allows paralegals to provide advice on site. Or through retention, where you can hire a paralegal instead of a lawyer. We need to provide greater information and make that information easier to understand. So there are a lot of possibilities. But as I said, right now we're in the information gathering stage. So I can envision a lot of things that we might do, but I can't tell what we're going to do. I'll come back in the fall when we have our final recommendations to tell you what we're going to do.
It sounds like the task force is trying to think about some remedies that might not necessarily come with a big price tag.
That's exactly right.
Is there any prospect for some funding for reforms if it's needed?
Well, there's always the request for funding to aid in, for example, legal aid clinics. But that's part of the political process, and we leave it to the partisans to fight that battle. As members of the judiciary, we can always support that. But we're trying to take things into our own hands right now and see what we can do within our own branch of government to provide greater information and access to justice with the resources that we have.
You know, you alluded to this a little bit earlier, but in 2017, the Legal Services Corporation found that only 10% of people who have civil legal problems in their own lives recognize that their issue might be resolved by the civil justice system. That's kind of heartbreaking. Is it hard to ask people to turn to the law when they need help?
I don't quite understand what you're asking.
Well, given that people may not even realize that they might have something going on, you know, whether it's a dispute or some kind of employment issue that could find a remedy in the courts, it sounds like at least part of what the task force is wrestling with is how to make people more aware that they can participate in the civil justice system.
Well, that's right. That is one of the more difficult tasks we have in front of us, is how do we get people who have legal issues and aren't even aware of them into a place where they can get assistance to make this issue, this problem in their life, more resolvable.
Do you have any thoughts on what makes the system more approachable in that regard?
Well, for a long time, even going back 30 years ago when I was in law school, there was what was called the movement for plain English or to get rid of legalese. But the fact of the matter is that our profession still is very much into phrases of art and legal terms that are not easily understood. So one of the things we really need to do is make even the forms that you can pick up at the local court more easily understood, make them easier to get through, and to make them understandable by a person of average intelligence.
Have you ever had a personal experience with the civil court system?
Oh, several. I recall, I think I was in college, maybe just out of high school, getting a ticket. I played hockey. I came home. It was late at night. I'm sure I was stopped because they thought maybe I was coming home from the bar, but I was coming home from the ice rink, and I got a ticket. I didn't think I was was speeding or whatever. I can't even recall what it was, but I wanted to go to court. And I was in by myself, and I was so intimidated by the way the judge was talking. With the benefit of a life in the law, I now understand the judge was just going through the process. But to me, it seemed as if the judge was barking at me, and it was so hard. I thought I was prepared, and I went in there, and I couldn't get my words out. That still is something that's in the back of my mind. Every time that I have a proceeding with someone who's not represented by a lawyer, I try to make sure I look them in the eye and give them the opportunity to say what they want to say without cutting them off or asking questions. Because I know for me now, it's just part of what I do, and it's my day-to-day affair. But people who are unfamiliar with the system come in, and they're very nervous and they're very intimidated.
Justice Brian Zara of the Michigan Supreme Court. He'll be in attendance at the public meeting tonight starting at 6 o'clock at the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers Union Hall. That's in Corktown in Detroit. Justice Zara, thanks for making time for us.
Thank you. It's my pleasure. Thanks for making time for me.
Cape Canaveral, watch your back. Here comes Oscoda. Oscoda, Michigan, located right on the shores of Lake Huron with a population just under 1,000, is in contention to become a rocket launch site. The Michigan Launch Initiative is a joint effort between the state and Michigan's aerospace businesses. The Oscoda Wurtsmith Airport, formerly home to a military airfield, has topped the list of 8 potential sites for the evolving horizontal and vertical rocket launch industry. Justin Casper is with the Department of Climate and Space Sciences and Engineering at the University of Michigan. He's also principal investigator for all the instruments on the Parker Solar Probe. Justin, welcome to Stateside.
Great to be here, April.
Why is Oscoda the kind of place that one might want to launch a rocket?
Well, you might think this is a little surprising. When we think of rocket launches, you're always looking for the cheapest way to get as much mass into space as possible. And it turns out a wonderful way to cheat is to go as close to Earth's equator as possible, because that part of Earth's surface is spinning the fastest. So you don't see a lot of launches normally at high latitudes like this. But there's another way to launch a rocket, which is actually to put it on an airplane, have the airplane take it up to a high altitude, and then it launches when it's already above a lot of the atmosphere and the friction that the atmosphere has. That's this horizontal launch that you referred to. And so this is as compelling a location as any. We're starting to see a lot of different companies developing new rockets and new launch capabilities, and Michigan wants to be a part of that.
And here I always thought that places like Florida and Texas were hubs because of the awesome weather, but it's actually that position on the globe.
Yes.
So the horizontal launches that you referred to, this is, seems sort of like a reversal on what we learned from the space shuttles, which came down in a horizontal position. Where are the existing horizontal launch projects happening right now?
Well, I think the most common United States horizontal launch you'll hear about are the Pegasus rockets that the Orbital Sciences Corporation developed. And those generally launch out of Kennedy in Florida or in Kwajalein in the Pacific Ocean. But there's nothing barring them from launching at different locations if the right runway and facilities existed.
Could you explain who's going to be in the decision-making position to decide whether OSCOTUS is really going to get the nod?
Oh, that's a great question. You know, the state has to be willing to support maintenance of the airport, and then there are going to be some regulatory hurdles. The nice thing about launching from the middle of the Pacific Ocean on a nearly abandoned atoll or from Florida into the Atlantic Ocean is that if something goes wrong and the rocket were to fall to Earth, it'll crash in the water. So I think one of the major hurdles will be working with the federal government on getting approval to launch something that might have toxic fuels and other bad compounds in it.
Right. Is it more likely that a site like this would be more heavily used by NASA or by private sector projects?
That's a great question. It has been incredible just in the last 5 years watching the explosion of access to space. So it's not uncommon these days if almost any federal large launch happens, be it from NASA or the Department of Defense, that you will see dozens of small satellites popping off of the rocket as the main payload's reaching space. And it's not uncommon now when like we go to large scientific conferences to have people from these small companies that are providing launch opportunities just giving you their business cards and saying like, hey, do you want to launch into space? And so if you can fundraise the money, and for some of these opportunities, we're only talking about a couple million dollars, which is incredibly cheap for access to space compared to what we would pay 10 years ago. It's possible for private organizations to provide their own launch opportunities.
So it sounds like for a site like OSCOTUS to be financially feasible, it would need to accommodate both,
public
and private.
Absolutely. Yeah. Though usually the best path is if you can partner with the government on some launches and establish a reliable base, and then you work out into industry.
You know, you mentioned the fact that there would need to be some safety hurdles cleared before this project would move forward. Folks around OSCOTUS are still dealing very much with contaminants to their water as a result of Wirt Smith being there before. What's your best sales pitch to them to consider deepening its connection with flight and with space, given what's already happened to the land and their public utilities as a result of it?
That's a great question. As someone who uses well water myself, I'm intimately familiar with this concern, and I have the same concerns anyone else had. The good news is people are developing much cleaner and safer chemicals for launch than you would have seen used years ago. And in fact, in particular for these smaller satellites, which I'd expect to see would be the best opportunity for this horizontal launch. Green fuels might sound a little silly, but specifically what we mean is developing fuels that are not toxic. So one of the big issues when you see something go wrong in a rocket launch is people often send out alerts like, don't touch the rocket parts if you see anything. And that's not just for collecting the wreckage. If things use something like hydrazine is a common chemical, that can actually be dangerous. So I think one thing to look out for is, you know, in pursuing an opportunity like this, you know, are we able to use rockets with safe chemicals?
In the case of OSCOTUS, the contamination had less to do with fuel than it did with firefighting foam. Are you saying that those kinds of chemicals, which still are not really regulated, would never be in play at a facility like this?
I would doubt at this point, given what we're learning about the chemicals, that anyone would voluntarily take on that kind of persistent chemical in any fire retardation system at this point.
What part does having a research institution like the University of Michigan play in making a launch site viable?
Well, this is very interesting. You know, there are a few very exciting things happening in the state of Michigan all at the same time involving space. So at the University of Michigan, we have several departments where we're training undergraduates, master's students, PhD students, a future workforce for people interested in aerospace, in designing these ever smaller and more capable spacecraft and the sensors that we put on them. And we just created what we call Michigan Space, which is a virtual institute that spans a lot of our different departments. We've come to realize that there are more than 100 faculty at the university that are all interested in different aspects of space, everything from physically getting something into orbit to working on the law or the economic side of space. And so we decided, you know, we wanted to organize and to have a larger impact within the state. At the same time, you see these industries coming together to partner to look for supporting a launch site. And I think we're all keying off of a couple things, realizing that this is something that a state can go after. In particular, in the state of Michigan, you have a lot of highly educated students coming out of the universities. You also have a lot of available physical space, industrial space that might have been used in the auto manufacturing industry. That's pretty amazing if you're looking to start up a company. We just need to pull the talent into the state and keep them from going to the coasts.
People don't necessarily think of Michigan when they think of aerospace, but how big are the flight-related industries within the state?
Well, actually, some of the very first scientific payloads ever launched into Earth's upper atmosphere had their genesis at the University of Michigan. At the end of World War II, some leftover V-2 rockets that were recovered from Germany were used for scientific applications. And the University of Michigan got in at the very beginning developing some experiments that measured the composition of Earth's upper atmosphere, its temperature and pressure. Different scientists and engineers just within the university system have been developing payloads to explore the solar system, the planets, the sun, from the very beginning of the space age. And then if you branch out, you'll recognize a lot of companies with a footprint in Michigan that have been involved in developing the kind of sensors, power systems that you'll find in communication satellites, not just scientific missions. So we already have a pretty good footprint here. What I think we really need to vitalizes that startup culture. So not just large manufacturing companies that are making components, but can we attract some new smaller companies here too?
Justin Casper is with the U of M's Department of Climate and Space Sciences and Engineering. Justin, thanks for stopping in.
Oh, thank you so much.
Up next, Michigan's renewable energy future. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Consumers Energy, which provides power for more than 6.5 million Michiganders, has announced it is aiming for two ambitious goals: phasing out reliance on coal-fired power and reaching net zero carbon emissions by 2040, if not sooner. If it sounds like the company is swinging for the fences, it kind of is. Here's Consumers CEO Patty Poppe.
Every great achievement has started with a goal. Somebody stating something that isn't true today that will be true in the future.
Patty Poppe, who is a native Michigander and whose father worked as a nuclear engineer in the utility industry, acknowledged that if you look at the company's capacity today, it might not look like it could happen, but she says she's confident that there is a path to completing at least 80% of the company's goal right now.
And then the last 20%, we have confidence in the next 20 years, the know-how of my team can be put to good use to figure out how to do the rest.
Poppe divulged these plans to Michigan Radio's Tracy Samilton, who joins us now. Hi, Tracy.
Hello.
Can we back up for a minute? Anything that people should know about Consumers and where it stands right now, or just the climate in which this was divulged?
Well, I think we need to start with a definition of, you know, really what she's saying, net zero. What does carbon net zero really mean? And what that means is you reduce your use of fossil fuels as much as possible, you know, gas and coal. And then you balance out the remainder. So if you still have some emissions going out there, you figure out other things you can do to pull carbon out of the atmosphere, like planting trees or keep methane from going from a landfill out into the atmosphere. So it's a balancing act so that you get to zero. You're no longer contributing anything to the carbon load.
But just to be clear, it doesn't necessarily mean any less power production or necessarily, depending on how that equation balances out.
Well, with Consumers Energy, it does mean, as you said, no more coal after 2040. And they're not going to build new gas plants either. And that is really an unusual step to be taking. And it's definitely going to help them meet this goal that they have.
Did you hear anything else from Patty Poppe about how Consumers hopes to reach its goals?
Energy efficiency is going to be huge. Most people, maybe they're thinking about, you know, maybe I should get a smart thermostat. In 20 years, we're going to be using energy so much differently than we're using it right now. You know, the consumers in particular is going to have all these programs where you can sign up to pay more at a certain time or reduce your use at a certain time. You'll get paid to reduce your use at peak demand times.
Wow. Like possibly turning down your air conditioning at times when everybody else is trying to use theirs?
Yes. There will be actually sort of compensation programs to make sure that your behavior helps consumers' energy meet its energy efficiency goals.
You look at the big picture a lot. Is this big news within the energy industry?
It's pretty big news. There are five other companies, including DTE Energy, actually, that have said we'll get to net zero by 2050. But I think the reason you didn't hear anything much when DTE Energy made this commitment is there was really nothing there to back it up. They just said we're going to do it. But at the same time, they're building a $1 billion natural gas plant and say they might build more. Whereas consumers is really sort of putting it out on the table and saying this is how we're going to get there.
Michigan Radio's Tracy Samilton. Tracy, thank you.
Thank you.
Late last week, Michigan's Public Service Commission recommended significant changes to DTE Energy's long-term plan for energy resources. The vote was unanimous, 3-0. The commission's main criticisms were that the company had done no competitive bidding for renewable projects like wind and solar in its future and had not provided sufficient reasons to keep open one of its largest coal-fired power plants. So what now for the state's largest utility? Margreta Kearney is a senior attorney and utility expert based in Grand Rapids with the Environmental Law and Policy Center, and she joins us today. Margreta, welcome to Stateside.
Thanks, April. It's great to be here.
How big a deal is this? Can DTE go back to the drawing board after hearing what the commission had to say?
Yeah, this is a really big deal, and I think DTE can go back to the drawing board. Really, what this is for DTE is a pivotal moment where it has to make a decision about how it is going to respond to the commission, how it's going to work with this commission over the next 6 years, how responsive it's going to be to customers and the 5,000 customer comments that showed up on the record in this case, and whether it's going to take the attitude, okay, there are issues with this plan, let's sit down, let's fix them, let's try to make it right, or if DTE is just going to say, you know what, nope, we're not doing it, we're not coming back with a revised plan.
Could you unpack for us why the Public Service Commission has been so intent on making sure that power companies get their renewable projects through competitive bidding?
Yeah, I mean, the Public Service Commission has really focused on competitive bidding because it's trying to protect customers and trying to make sure prices stay down. Utilities naturally like to build big things and they like to build them themselves. And the reason for that is the way they earn money is they get a return on all of their capital expenditures. So if they spend a whole bunch of money themselves building a big plant, they get a big return on that and they make a lot of money.
They pay a lot in, but then they're allowed to recoup all the benefits.
Exactly.
Right.
But when they do competitive bidding and others come in at lower prices or come in and say, well, we can just sign a contract with you to sell you the energy instead of you building something yourself, then the company doesn't make as much money, but customers save a lot.
Well, what sort of issues would DTE have to resolve if it wanted to try to convert at least two of those three votes?
Well, DTE will have to submit a competitive bidding process, show that it has conducted a competitive bidding process. That piece sounds hard, but it actually shouldn't be too hard since the company has done some competitive bidding in other areas that it could submit in this case. A second point is related to energy waste reduction, which some people hear of as energy efficiency. And this is a hugely important piece for customers because it saves customers money. So energy waste reduction is when you do things like put in new LED light bulbs or have more efficient appliances so that you save money by actually using less energy. And you would think, well, why would a company want to have its customers use less energy? It's because they do get compensated for it. So that the commission kind of makes it a win-win for everybody. The company makes a little bit of money and customers save money. Well, DTE has been very resistant to increasing the amount of energy waste reduction it does. And the commission told it that it needed to go back and it needed to up its numbers and do more energy efficiency. So it's going to be really interesting to see if the company, after spending so much time digging in and saying it just couldn't do more, is going to come back with those higher numbers.
Why has it been such a struggle for DTE to transform its business and incorporate more renewables?
You know, I think that DTE has just taken some time to really come to the realization that the way we provide energy in this country is changing, that we've moved away from the old model of building some really big centralized plants, charging our customers a bunch of money for them and just sending it all out and not really giving them, the customers, any choice. Now they're contending with the fact that renewable energy has gotten much cheaper. Customers are much more aware of the environmental effects of the energy they use. And customers are also aware of the impact it has on their pocketbooks, right? Customers increasingly are looking to utilities and saying, why does it seem like my utility bill is occupying a much larger piece of my budget these days? So I think that there's really, and that's why I say this is a pivotal moment for DTE. I think that what the commission's decision gives them is the opportunity to signal a cultural shift and an acceptance that they are going to move into Michigan's energy future and not stick with the old way of doing things.
Let's talk about what's happening with another of the state's top drawer providers. Last Friday, regulators greenlit Jackson-based Consumers Energy, which has a plan to phase out coal-fired power plants. And I had to read this twice to make sure I was getting it right, to get to net zero emissions by 2040. Wow.
It's really pretty impressive. And you're absolutely right, April. They've made that commitment. And I think that this juxtaposition between consumers and DTE is really striking. And when I talk about that culture at DTE and that approach to regulating and to moving into the future, I think consumers has really done a much better job of embracing that and moving towards the future, saying, we're not going to build a gas plant. We're going to look at renewable energy. We're going to go out and do more energy waste reduction. And they've had, you know, the president of their company, Patty Poppe, coming out and meeting with people and saying, we want you to do more energy waste reduction. And I think that's a really impressive thing for the company to be doing.
Are there significant differences between the two companies' profiles in terms of their power generating assets at this point?
I mean, at this point, DTE does have a lot more coal on its books than consumers does. But in terms of the customers that they're serving, the areas that they're serving, the geography and climate that they're serving, there's really no reason for the two utilities to have starkly different plans.
So, I mean, is consumers' plan doable?
I certainly hope so. I mean, I think that one of the things that makes their plan more complicated but also more meaningful is that I understand the plan to include not just the generating assets, the solar arrays that the company builds, the wind farms that the company builds, but they're also thinking about the power that they purchase. So that's if they have an agreement with another company that generates, maybe it's a gas-fired plant, they're looking at that and saying, how can we get to net zero from that purchased energy? And even looking to the market, to the MISO market, at what they're purchasing from that market. That makes it more complicated for the company, but it also means that there will be a more meaningful reduction in carbon emissions.
Well, what kind of technologies will be critical to consumers being able to deliver on this? It sounds like they're banking on a lot of innovation between then and now.
Yeah, I think that they are. And I think that we do see a lot of that innovation really starting to come online. If you'd talked to me 10 years ago about solar, we would have been talking about that as a more emerging technology, something we're banking on in the future. And then you just saw this sort of hockey puck curve in prices and in adoption. I think that's what we're about to see with things like storage. So we're going to see that coming online a lot more and really playing an integral role in consumers' plan. I also think that they're getting better at operating programs where they can help customers shift their load to different times. So if you have a lot of big customers who use a lot of energy, and maybe you have one event every 3 months or every 6 months that suddenly requires a lot of energy use, let's be smart about figuring out if we can move that event, if we can smooth that out instead of having to build another plant or use a really old peaker plant to come online just to meet that need that doesn't occur very frequently.
Are you talking about industrial customers?
Yep, the big industrials, and you know, a lot of those companies are very interested in finding out if there are ways that they can do that so that it reduces overall costs. Right? If you can find a way to save money on it, and the utility is saving money, the customers are saving money, those are really win-wins that help everybody.
We have less than a minute left. It used to be that we talked about a lot of our energy innovation problems in terms of the grid's capacity. Are we much farther along than we were 10 years ago on that?
Yeah, I think we're just on the cusp of making some really big changes there. And one of the big things driving that is we're starting to integrate our planning on the grid, our distribution planning, with resource planning and figuring out how we can place resources and how we can place generation so that we're maximizing the use of our grid. And it doesn't mean that we necessarily have to spend a whole lot of money making it bigger and better. We just have to look at it differently and try to maximize the efficiencies that we can get out of the grid.
Margareta Kearney is with the Environmental Law and Policy Center. Thanks for talking with us today.
Thanks for having me, April.
Ice cover on Grand Traverse Bay is declining. It's not great for whitefish, but may offer some relief from high water levels. Interlochen Public Radio's Noelle Riley tells us more.
Right now, there's free flowing water on the bay.
We've got calm waters here in the western arm of Grand Traverse Bay. No ice formation yet.
That's Heather Smith, the baykeeper at the Grand Traverse Watershed. By this time last year and the year before, the bay was already frozen to Power Island.
We typically see the bay freezing in February or March. There are a few years when it did freeze in late January, but that is typically when we get those long periods of cold weather.
She says historically Grand Traverse Bay would freeze more than 50% of the time. But winter temperatures across the Midwest are the eighth warmest on record, according to the Midwest Regional Climate Center. Additionally, Lake Michigan is about 1 degree warmer this winter than last. And this weekend, temperatures could peak in the upper 30s and low 40s. Chances are that ice won't cover the bay this winter.
In the last 20 years, the bay has only froze 6 times, so we're seeing a reduction in ice cover in the last 20 years here in the Grand Traverse region. And that really is in parallel with what we're seeing in the entire Great Lakes. There's generally a downward trend for ice cover in all 5 of our Great Lakes.
She says it has to do with the changing climate. According to the National Oceanic Atmospheric Administration, ice cover has been on a downward trend since the 70s across the Great Lakes. That has big impacts for fish.
So for something like a whitefish, it's typically thought to be good if you have ice cover during the winter.
That's Steve Petoven, a fisheries biologist for NOAA. Whitefish spawn in November and hatch in late March or early April. So ice cover is good to protect the eggs from turbulent waters and wave action.
And that's just sort of kind of been the holy grail for whitefish.
But ice cover is not great for other species like alewife and yellow perch, he says. Winter can be hard for those fish. Although alewife is an invasive species, introduced salmon, a popular sports fish, rely on them for food.
Everything is just sort of a matter of perspective on what you're looking at, or there's trade-off.
According to baykeeper Heather Smith, ice cover also affects water levels and shoreline erosion.
More evaporation can lead to lower lake levels. I know that everybody's watching that very closely as we're in one of our very high lake level years.
And if the bay doesn't freeze, that means more wave action will hit the shoreline, increasing erosion over the winter. But how about other bays up north? The Straits of Mackinac are frozen enough for hockey. St. Ignace hosted the annual Labatt Blue Pond Hockey Championship last weekend. And the ice has locked in the Starline Ferry that takes passengers to and from Mackinac Island. It stopped running on Valentine's Day, says Samantha York at Starline Ferry.
So right now it is pretty frozen over. However, it has frozen enough to lock us into the dock and to keep us from our departures.
She's used to the ferry being iced in until spring. But she says some people think the upcoming warm temperatures will break things up in the Straits.
Noelle Riley reporting. That story was featured on Points North, a weekly show and podcast from Interlochen Public Radio. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. That's our show for today. I'm April Baer. Thanks for listening. We'll see you on Tuesday.